Now we'll begin. This is program number 601. We'll begin side two of this broadcast, and it is June the 13th, 1983. Now, I'm going into Robert Byron Watson. I've mentioned him many times, and I'm going to be specific about him because what he said and what the House Select Committee didn't use with Robert Blakey and what Bernard Fensterwald didn't use and Dick Gregory didn't use and Mark Lane, and they all knew about it, and the entire staff of the House Select Committee is very important. Now, Robert Byron Watson sent me some letters, and I'm going to share them with you and do letter number one tonight, and maybe each week do another part of the letter or information about him. And some of you, I've mailed out the articles about him. If you want them, you can write to me and get the information and study it yourself. The first I knew of him was in 1976 in December. It was undated because I don't remember the day. He got a hold of my name and wrote me a letter. Then in January of 1977, David Wemple, a researcher, wrote to me about Watson and asked me if I was familiar with him at all. In 1977, in March, Robert Watson wrote again to me. In April of 77, he wrote to me. In July, David Wemple wrote an article for the Hudson Valley Chronicle, which details the role of Watson's experiences with the men who were involved in killing John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And in September of 77, he wrote me another letter. December, I got another letter and then a Christmas card, and I have not heard from him since. And then in November of 77, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was doing their work, he signed an affidavit and detailed what he wanted them to investigate, and of course, they never did. Now, when I read you his first letter, he had not defined for a while certain names. He refers to a man who he went to Thailand with. He was arrested for narcotics traffic. He was part of a gang. He worked at an art gallery, Watson, and was an expert on antiques and jewelry and didn't realize when he got sucked into this what it was. And he goes to Thailand on a trip with a man named Bill Jackson. And he also works with a man named Herman Ballard, B-A-L-L-A-R-D. And the alias for Herman Ballard is Herman Jackson also. But he didn't know, and he revealed later as he went on, that he had another alias. And that was the most important one because Herman Jackson was known as Mr. Walter Alfred Jack Youngblood. And those of you that know the story of the murder of Martin Luther King and the intelligence operation, Youngblood surfaced as the man who could have stood down below the Lorraine Motel and shot Martin Luther King. One shot blew his head off, and it wasn't James Earl Ray in the rooming house. And Youngblood is also connected to the CIA, to the Caribbean, to Guatemala, and the Warren Commission had a lot of information on Jack Ruby. And you'd have to look up Youngblood's name, even surfaces later with information about the links to the John Kennedy assassination. Army intelligence, CIA, FBI. James Earl Ray identified pictures of Youngblood as the man he that was tailing him several days before Martin Luther King was killed. And he recognized him. And Youngblood is the man who shows up later. He's the bag man for Eugene Hale Brading, B-R-A-D-I-N-G. Part of the Denver, Colorado Mafiosa, and Brading is an important person with Cleveland Mafia and so forth, and many of you know the work of Brading in the murder of John Kennedy. I don't want to digress too far, but he was working with Herman Ballard, alias Herman Jackson, Mr. Youngblood, but he didn't know their role in these murders. He heard them talking just before Martin Luther King was killed, but Robert Kennedy died a month later, and John Kennedy, of course, in 63. Now, the letter he sent me, I want to just start with that letter. This was the early one of about December 1976. I got a letter from him, just as I did from Mr. James Frankenberry, who recognized at the time of the Watergate the arrest of E. Howard Hunt. He recognized him it being at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and recruiting people from the special forces for hit teams. And that he told how he was trained to assassinate a person, a dignitary, riding on a rail train at Crossfire, and realized it was a simulation of John Kennedy's murder. But several other people were selected from that group, and they were supposed to shoot at General Walker and blame Lee Harvey Oswald for that. Again, an agent provocateur activity. Well, I've done broadcasts on Youngblood, and I've done them on Frankenberry and Youngblood. But let me go right to what Watson said, because then you get to know him if you hear what he wrote. He said to me, "You should receive some lengthy material regarding the murder of Reverend Martin Luther King and my troubles, my tremendous troubles, as a result of my attempt to give the information I had to the federal government. I overheard a portion of the conspiracy to assassinate Dr. Martin Luther King week prior to the murder. The reference was also made to President Kennedy's assassination. My mother and myself were threatened by the assassins because I told my mother about the plot. And I said, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. If Martin Luther King is killed, he did not go to the police because he didn't believe the people who would be talking about it in the back room of this particular art gallery would do it if somebody was there listening. But they probably thought, because he had traveled or been with them, that he was sympathetic to what they were doing. He said, I told my mother about it. I was fearful. And that is why I kept silent until 1970. In 1970, we tried to bring attention to the officials within the federal government. Now, remember, in 70, there was no House Select Committee on Assassinations. Klaus Barbie was working with the government. The hit teams were all over the world. Nixon was in his heyday. It wasn't yet Watergate, and the federal government wouldn't do anything. And those, with the heyday of J. Edgar Hoover, with his Nazi assassinations from Interpol, his death squads, and Division 5 of the FBI, and their death squads were training in Mexico, and also the links to organized crime. So he's frustrated. I tried to bring it to the attention of the federal government. But in 1970, I learned about Bernard Fensterwald. He was a lawyer from Washington who surfaced and formed a committee to investigate assassinations. He was getting quite a bit of publicity. So I contacted Bernard Fensterwald. What this poor Chinook didn't know, that Fensterwald turns out to be James McCord's lawyer and also Marianne Paisley and the CIA. But he didn't know that, and he heard about him, and he contacted him. After I contacted him, threats started coming to us. The very assassins whom I had informed on contacted me and my mother. They threatened to kill us and burn our house down. They said they were the syndicate, and the syndicate was a government within a government, and they had high people within the government who they worked with. And that's what Lewis Tackwood said in 1971. His book came out in 73, but Watson is writing his own story and has never heard of Tackwood. So what he's talking about is a government within a government. And then we see later, this is 77, that Larry McDonald, in fact, does have a computer down in Los Angeles, a clearinghouse with the police department. And, oh, I forgot to tell you on the biography of Mr. Wigner that he goes back and forth to Germany, and there's a German office for the police files from the United States that go over to Germany. He tried to contact them. He didn't know Larry McDonald was part of that. He knew he was funded by the syndicate, but he didn't know how high up this went. Or that the partner of Larry McDonald, Roy Cohn, was named in Permandex, or that Mr. Milliken was chairman of Jerry Peter Gray's. He didn't know all that. You know, other people on the board, George Patton III and so forth, General John Singlob and Admiral Thomas Moore. At the time that in the 70s, when he's trying to tell the government what's going on, Henry Kissinger and Fritz Kramer and Haig and Admiral Moore are even stealing off Richard Nixon's desk, and Edward Teller working with Henry Kissinger and the Harvard group. He's going to a group like all of us did. We made plenty of mistakes and got burnt in individual ways. We didn't know what we were dealing with. It was really a raw time. He said his home was broken into. I believe it, because mine was too. I don't think he's paranoid. Heroin from Bangkok was mailed to my home and my mother and myself. And then the police came. It came in a package, and the police came and they arrested him and put him in jail. And they said, well, we'll get you off the narcotic rap if you keep quiet and do the things that we ask you to do, travel for us and be a courier. So they had him. Just like Lewis Tackwood was caught on a charge, and then they have him, and they say, well, do our work, or else we'll put you in jail, and we can send more to you. So that's how he got sucked into this terrible thing. He says that the men were interested in my case. Bernard Fensterwald said he was, and Ken Smith, it turns out they really weren't, but he thought they were. They continued to investigate what I gave them. They discovered some very important things. And Fensterwald and Smith believe I am completely truthful and honest. Now, look back at the time slot in the 70s with these thieves, Fensterwald and Smith. I mean, these lecherous thieves are coming around. Fensterwald came to my house. And then 6 weeks after, we had that tragic accident. And wherever they traveled, everybody had not everybody, almost everybody had terrible tragedies happen to them. We were all sucked in. And he is believing, see, this is written to me, that they came to me and they thought I was truthful and honest, he's saying, and this information is important to them in their recent attempts to get James Earl Ray a new trial. Oh, boy. You know, they became the attorney for James Earl Ray, as did Mark Lane. You see how much this has come out, okay? He said, I felt then by 1974, he'd given them this, with Watergate sufficiently removed all the corruption within the federal government, that then I should recontact Fensterwald and Smith. And that's another naivete, that Watergate removed the corruption. It just moved it to a tighter fist, like Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig and Fritz Kramer in the Pentagon. It didn't end the corruption. It took out one bunch of sleazy guys and brought in a team that even had more muscle. It took the amateurs out and brought in the strong ones, okay? Now, he says, the federal government finally framed me, he said, for my talking about the syndicate, because I was aware of a major smuggling operation involving cocaine from South America. It involved Brad Marcello, like Carlos Marcello, Nick the Catry, C-A-T-R-I, Jerry Prokos, involved in South America, the narcotic context. This is, he caught on to that. Ken Smith was told by me about certain customs, U.S. customs, the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Treasury Department. And a drug enforcement agent came to my home and suggested that I work for them as a special employee for several weeks, and that I would get some narcotics and that I would sell it, and then they would catch the people who were buying it from me. This is what Watson said. The Drug Enforcement Agency came to him, and they were arranging a deal to catch the narcotic dealers because he had uncovered a smuggling operation, and it involved also agents of the Drug Enforcement Agency. So what happened to him? He says, why I'm writing to you and why I have to get the attention of the Senate and Congressional Committee and bring my case before you was that in the pretext that he was going to catch the drug dealers, they in turn arrested him for the narcotics, and then he went to a federal penitentiary. And his innocence goes on and on, because he mentions also in the series of letters that follow Larry McDonald. But I wanted to show you how he got caught in a prison, and they said once you're in prison with a drug charge, you will never get out, or you won't be cleared, and you'll have this record. Nobody will ever believe you because of the drug charge. So this is Robert Byron Watson, and I will do a lot more on him following the chronology of the dates I gave, because they're very important, and the role of Mr. Youngblood with the mafia, with Eugene Hale Brading, and also, see, he was talking about the connections, and we'll go into that soon, and I mentioned it before, between Chile and Jordan and Palestine. And it was from that area that Sirhan family was brought to Pasadena. I wrote an article for Midnight on that a long time ago. I'll have reprints made for you on that, because they were brought in by the Greek Orthodox Church. And in that book, Wanted Search for the Nazis, that I referred to earlier, they have a section on the Greek Orthodox Church, the Tolstoy Foundation, the same foundation that brought in Marina Oswald from the Soviet Union as a spy, brought in the Sirhan family to Pasadena. And Larry McDonald's group, working with the George Habish and his brother George in over in Lebanon and his brother in Chile, formed a perfectly tight triangle up to the United States from those two areas to couple the Middle East at one end, as I said, the South America at the other, and the United States from Alabama and Miami and Georgia, and the narcotics being distributed and then into the United States, and with strongholds in Denver, Detroit, and Cleveland. And by 1957, the syndicate had had their meeting and set up these various agencies for distribution, of course. But Larry McDonald, coming out of that milieu of Murrieta, Georgia, with this whole gang out of Atlanta, Georgia, goes on to Washington and forms Western Goals with the staff of the Pentagon, these high named people, and has a tremendous power with funding from NASA and the Atomic Energy and the various professors to give him respectability. Now, I gave a quotation of Western Gold's goal because of the threat of the Olympics and how they have to keep this list and how the FBI has been curtailed. They said the voice of the FBI has been crippled, the crippling of the FBI. What he doesn't say is the excuse for keeping the list as far as crippling. If any of you remember the COINTELPRO program and what came out of the Watergate hearings and the Senator Church Committee and Representative Pike and even the Rockefeller Commission, the crippled FBI included the MK Ultra, the MK Artichoke, assassinations, murders, drug control, drug experimentations in 80 hospitals and prisons in the United States, mind damage where people still haven't gotten over and have recurrent mental problems, assassinations. Mark Clark in Chicago, they won a huge suit for killing a black person who was in bed asleep, breaking down the doors. And that was Charles Bates in Chicago, and who went on to form the SLA in San Francisco. They had agent provocateurs on the campuses, illegal entering, forging, breaking up marriages like Jean Seberg's and lying about pregnancies and love affairs. And then she dies and her husband dies. Tragic endings to FBI lies, forging letters to parents on what their children were doing, targeting minority leaders who will be the head of the Chicanos, who will be the head of the blacks, formed the SLA, created the Manson family with Charles Watson out of Texas with Beverly Hills lawyers, the Isla Vista riots at the Bank of America, the importation of narcotics, J. Edgar Hoover's buddies in the mafia, thick with the syndicate, the Larry McDonald Syndicate and the Birch Society, political candidates framed, murdered, covered up, J. Edgar Hoover with Interpol, vice president of Hitler's list that Ronald Reagan is sending back to Germany and they can put into the computers of Western goals. That is the crippled FBI, and what Larry McDonald wants is safety at the Olympics. Now, I mentioned a few weeks ago an article in the Wall Street Journal called Mideast Intrigue, PLO operative slain, reputedly by the Israelis, was helping the United States. Now, this fellow was killed by the Israelis January 22nd, 1979. Ali Hassan Salameh, A-L-I-H-A-S-S-A-N-S-A-L-A-M-E-H. Why did the Wall Street Journal put an article in February 1983 about a man who was murdered in 1979? Because, like Klaus Barbie, he worked for the CIA. He worked with Israel and Israeli intelligence. He worked with Gemayel. He was helpful to the United States government. He worked with Henry Kissinger, who I've said it long ago and frequently is a highest level Nazi. He had contacts with Kissinger starting in July 73. He set up, and also with General Vernon Walters, he set up the Black September Group, the murder of Jordanian Prime Minister, the attempted murder of the Jordanian ambassador to London, bomb attacks on oil storages, electronic facilities in Europe, hijacking of Sabena Airline. See, Black September was set up by Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson and the Nguyen Bank. American taxpayer money going from Australia to Chile and Argentina, Bolivia, Paraguay, and also to Jordan and to the PLO and the radical groups. His father was a devout, ardent Nazi, worked with Adolf Hitler, wanted to poison the oil wells in Palestine as a diversionary from the famous Battle of the Bulge. This guy worked with the American government, and what caught the interest of the Washington Post in 1983 was that the Munich massacre was set up by Salameh and people working for the United States government. Now, Larry McDonald, from his files and computer to the Los Angeles Police Department and his links to J. Peter Grace and Mr. Wigner and Milliken and Edward Teller, says we have to not have violence down in Los Angeles with the Olympics, when he is directly linked to those people that formed Mr. Salameh's organization and worked with his father, who worked with Hitler and the Grand Mufti. This was an article in the Wall Street Journal. You can get it February the 10th, 1983, on the Munich massacre arrangement, arranged by a man who says right there his strange arrangements with the American government. He works with the American government, sets up the Munich massacre, and then Larry McDonald says, because of the Munich massacre, I have to spy on you, even though I was told it was illegal. Now, David Emery sent me a book last week. He lives up in the North Bay Area, if you don't know who he is. And he does a radio show, talk shows, and has a fantastic program going up there, Perth's World Watcher, up there on two stations during the week. He sent me a book called The Quest for the Red Prince by Michael Barr, B-A-R-Z-O-H-A-R. That's Barr Zohar. And here's the second name, Eaton Haber, E-I-T-A-N-H-A-B-E-R. This is put out by Morrow and Company, New York, 1983. This book goes into the role of the Salome family. Ali Hassan Halame, it describes, was born in Palestine, the son of an Arab terrorist. And it tells how his father was killed and that he volunteered in 1967 to help liberate his homeland. See, this comes from American money that he's going to do this. As head of the PLO, Ali was the chief planner of the terrorist Black September and masterminded the Munich Olympic Games. And again, Mr. Salome, he's dead, but his organization, the PLO group, is set up by Mr. Habash, who works directly with Larry McDonald's group that put Larry McDonald in as representative of Georgia in Congress in Washington, D.C. Incidentally, on the Warren Commission, along with Gerald Ford and Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy, all involved in covering up and setting up these death squads. Gerald Ford didn't do that. This was McCloy and Alan Dulles with the fiancés of death, the death squads in all South America and in the Middle East, Idi Amin, and the Nazi trained by Otto Skorzeny. That was Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy on the Warren Commission. And along with them was Mr. Richard Russell of Georgia, right out of Atlanta, Georgia. He once said, "Don't ask me what I can do for the country. I'm here to see what the country can do for Georgia," which was a lot of narcotics, the Georgia Atlanta Mafia. Coca-Cola has their, maybe you've read the Cola Wars between Pepsi and Coca. When Jimmy Carter's in, it's Coca-Cola. When Reagan and Nixon are in, it's Pepsi. But you can have your choice. And the headquarters of Lockheed with their huge multi-million dollar payoff scandals of spies. Now, this is a new book, The Quest for the Red Prince, and it tells about how the Mossad tried to get this guy, tried to kill him, and finally did it in January 1979. It tells about his work in Cairo and, of course, Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's head of the special forces equivalent for search and capture and escape, and it set up, his team began to set up counterintelligence, dressing Germans in American uniforms, teaching them English. The master of spying, the master of escapes, he went to Middle East with Eichmann to help set up the teams of Sadat and Nasser and Gaddafi and Idi Amin and into the PLO. And while they were doing that simultaneously, the Nazis from South America were doing that. The American CIA was using Otto Skorzeny out of Madrid and South America, and the CIA was using the whole team, Klaus Barbie and all of these people, to set up the continuation of the Grand Mufti and Adolf Hitler's plans in the Middle East. The Red Prince describes the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine as an extreme left-wing organization whose leader, gray-haired, arrogant George Habash, preached not only the destruction of Israel, but the toppling of conservative Arab regimes and world revolution, which includes also blowing up the oil wells. That's one of the plans of even the Saudi family, of having a total revolution and training their children or grandchildren in the future. Now, George Habash is in this book many times over in The Red Prince, and George Habash works directly in the art gallery and with the team that talked about the plans to kill Martin Luther King 1 week later, that talked about using Sirhan as a patsy and working with the Jordanian Palestinians and getting him to be the front man and using a guard from Lockheed to shoot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head and working with people who are at Dealey Plaza and talking about killing John Kennedy at Dealey Plaza. They talked about that as if that was a fait accompli, and they thought that Robert Byron Watson was part of them and that they were free to talk, just as Louis Tackwood was part of the syndicate and went to the Los Angeles Police Department. And something triggered. Once in a while, people have a conscience. It doesn't come from the left or the middle or even the poor uprising or feeling oppressed. Most people are pretty drugged and entertained. They have the sports and the television. I always hit those in their movies and their Academy Awards and the Emmys and the Tonys. And you can have something almost every night, your country western and so forth. You have your ball games and your series, and if it isn't one, basketball, baseball, and football, and your various leagues, and you have your team. So the breaks that you get, such as they bring in Klaus Barbie, who lurks for the United States government, as I say, I'll do more next week, comes from Mr. and Mrs. Clarsfield. It just took two people. A lot of people are pessimistic. Or some women I was talking to today that I knew said to me, well, how can you do this? Isn't it depressing? No, it's not depressing. It's interesting. If somebody wrote to me, do you sleep at night? You bet I sleep at night. Is it depressing to go to the doctor and have a lump and being told it's cancer? Did you get the cancer out? I mean, life was never free of depression, but there's a challenge here in understanding these various people. And maybe the anniversary of just starting my 13th year here is a good time to say that while I've been on the air and I have the tapes and the big reels, we reeled to reeled at first and the cassettes, and they're available going back to 1977, but I could activate the early ones if you wanted to hear them, what we talked about when the Pentagon Papers broke. I have the press conference I had, the LA Press Club, with the Watergate story. But the point is that everything that I've mentioned, and I've covered a lot of area, the atomic energy, NASA, the plans for genocide, the space stations, the interconnecting Vatican links, the Israeli Nazis, the Henry Kissinger Nazi conclave, everything that I've said has one central theme, and it goes back, so that it's not too confusing, it goes back to John Kennedy's assassination. Who killed Kennedy? And as I studied that, and that'll be 20 years this November, as I studied John Kennedy, I tapped into members of the crime syndicate, the mafia. I tapped into the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and his agents that covered it up. You find members of the Pentagon that were part of it. There were people from, say, the crime syndicate, the deposed monarchies, the czars, the white Russians, the Wrangels. Then you get the hard Nazis, the Nazi war criminals. And I had to get a lot of books. I read a lot of articles. What are the common denominators between these people? Their common denominator is that they don't like the Soviet Union, whether it's the Vatican or the Mossad or the death squads in Argentina. They don't like the Soviet Union. They're threatened by the division of property and wealth, and they have decided to make weapons to make war and end it, because it's a time whose idea may come, and socialism, such as in Cuba or in Spain, which is socialist now, or Italy or Sweden, the world isn't coming apart because there's less accumulation by one group or another, and that's something I'm not going to go into tonight. The fear of that very fact of dividing up property has caused people to mass murder, to lie, to forge, to wiretap, to steal, to rationalize, to plead that if you're an anti-communist, we all have something in common. And that isn't true. These disconnecting links come together, and the common denominator is this fear of the division of wealth. And what caused the Soviet Union to become such an armed camp was that every country wanted to topple them from 1919 on. So they had to accumulate more weapons and more intelligence because we didn't leave them alone. At that point, like, we were left alone. We had a revolution, the French Revolution. And if all the armies came in, it would be a different story. Well, our time is up now. I'm going more now next week into Robert Byron Watson, the Klaus Barbie article, and discuss with you some more that he says getting into the art gallery and Larry McDonald, and then we'll go full cycle on more to Western Ghouls. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel at KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove. You take care, do your reading and studying, and I'll be back with you next week.